Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, a continuation of our ongoing, in-depth investigative reporting series on abuses in psychiatry. Our specific focus today, electroconvulsive therapy. We're going to talk with both the psychologist, Seth Farber, and a physician, Maru Dolan, concerning what they believe is either the misuse or overuse of this very common, and as you'll see, a very popular therapy. We've been told that it helps people with depression, that it can help people return to a life that's normal and productive. What aren't we told? What aren't we told concerning what actually happens in the brain? That's our program today. Let me begin by sharing some of the views of other individuals. I'll be quoting verbatim from some of the reports that normally would not be making into most of the American public's radar screen. This is a part of The Shocking Truth, Part 4, Forced Electroconvulsive Therapy Isn't Just the Stuff of Movies by Liz Spiegel. I'll quote, "I've always been somewhat awed by the Hippocratic Oath. Unlike the presidential oath of office, forever tarnished by Billy's perjury, the Hippocratic Oath is still imbued with dignity. I saw this at work on 60 Minutes Sunday in a story about a mentally ill man who had been moved from death row to a psychiatric facility once it was discovered he was incompetent to stand trial. His doctor had the ability to make him well enough to stand trial, but told Leslie Stahl that making a man well enough in order to give him getting killed violated his notion of the Hippocratic Oath's primary dictum, do no harm. Why didn't doctors who perform electroconvulsive therapy feel the same way? New York State Supreme Court Justice W. Bromley Hall decided April 16th that Pilgrim Psychiatric Center on Long Island can resume its shock treatments of Paul Henry Thomas, despite Thomas's opposition. Thomas is a 49-year-old inpatient at Pilgrim, which is under the jurisdiction of the New York State Office of Mental Health. He immigrated to the United States from Haiti in 1982, though he had been diagnosed with schizoid affective disorder and bipolar mania, along with other diagnoses. He does not believe he is mentally ill. This, according to doctors at Pilgrim, is part of his illness, his lack of being aware if he's ill. Thomas did initially consent to electroconvulsive therapy in June of 1999. At that time, he was considered incompetent to consent. But after three treatments, he decided he'd had enough, at which point the Pilgrim doctors decided Thomas was incompetent. Newsday staff writer Zachary Dowdy characterized the situation as, quote, a kind of catch-22. The strange circumstance that Thomas was fine when he consented to the procedure, but mentally incompetent when he refused it. Since 1999, Thomas has received nearly 60 forced electric shocks. Part of the doctor's defense of Thomas' forced electric shock therapy was the patient's erratic behavior. Justice Hall agreed, writing in his decision, quote, he was wearing three pairs of pants, which he believed provided therapy for him. At the same time, he was found in the ward wearing layers of shirts, which were inside out, together with jackets, gloves, and sunglasses. Oh my God, somebody stop this man before he commits another fashion crime. Strap him down. Put him in a diaper, shove a mouth guard between his teeth, administer sedatives, and then induce a grand mal seizure in him against his will. Surely after that he'll be calm enough to consider a proper wardrobe. As his case heated up, Thomas issued a public statement in which he said, quote, I am currently undergoing forced electric shock treatment. It is horrible. I am strong, but no human being is invincible. I ask God to bless you in anticipation of your helping me in my torture and traumatization. Do whatever is possible. Unquote. Ann Krause worked as a peer advocate in the New York Office of Mental Health and was assigned to Thomas' case. Krause supported Thomas's fight against forced electroconvulsive therapy, which was ordered by her superiors to cease action on his behalf. On March 21st, Krause resigned. In her letter of resignation, she wrote, quote, "The New York State Office of Mental Health is taking the position that for me to actively advocate on my own time and at my own expense on behalf of Paul Thomas creates a conflict of interest for me on the job. Given the choice between continuing to work for an agency which so discount recipients' voices that it will repeatedly force electric shock on someone who has clearly said that he experiences it as torture, or advocating for this person's right to make his own decision about whether electricity should be run through his brain, I am choosing to advocate." Unquote. Referring to Thomas' history as a human rights activist, Krause said, quote, "I am following Mr. Thomas's own example in putting ideals of human rights and liberty before my desire for personal comfort or job security," unquote. Doctors said Thomas's liver would be, quote, "further damaged by giving him antipsychotics. Electroconvulsive therapy is approved, recommended, and effective primarily for depression. It has never been definitely proved in any clinical study to be effective for psychosis. Did someone fail to tell the judge that electroconvulsive therapy does not equal treatment for antipsychotics?" They also said one of the reasons Thomas denies his illness is because in Haiti, cultural perception of mental illness are different. Additionally, doctors admitted that if Thomas were at a private facility, he'd be unlikely to receive electroconvulsive therapy. Is it fair to discriminate someone simply because he doesn't have money for private care, or because he comes from a different culture? If this seems like an isolated case, one need look no farther than down the proverbial hall where 25 years ago, Adam Cesco also fights forced electric shock at Pilgrim. Cesco was granted a temporary restraining order. His mother told the Associated Press, quote, "I think it's horrible they are holding my son prisoner. I want the treatment stopped," unquote. Her son, a diagnosed schizophrenic, is allergic to the medication Pilgrims would prescribe. Forget the fact that Cesco and family prefer her psychotherapy instead of drugs. Why is Paul Henry Thomas being forcibly shocked while Adam Cesco, while admittedly in a horrible situation, is not? I wonder if it is because Thomas is black and Cesco is young and white. Isn't it more wrenching to read about a young man who played classical piano and won awards in grade school? The New York Post sees it this way, quote, "Mom in tears as docs treat her captive son," unquote, about Cesco, who says nothing about Thomas. Do no harm. Can anyone a pilgrim be said, like the doctor on 60 Minutes, to be guarding the integrity of the Hippocratic Oath? It would seem that in New York, the oath has long been forgotten. This mental health e-letter is posted as a service of the New York Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services, which is a statewide coalition of people who use and provide community mental health services. And so I want to share that with you. And by the way, I have interviewed myself. And in my discussion with Mr. Thomas, I found him to be lucid, completely aware of his predicament, and at no time were there any statements that he said that I found extraordinary. Or certainly, he is aware that he is being held a prisoner. This comes from an advocacy group. I'll quote it. "Picture a dark and stormy night, an elderly woman down in a puddle, convulsing. Next to her head, we see a live power line still sparking. Entry-exit points on the victim's temples are evidenced by faint first-degree burn marks. You're the doctor. What do? Apply the end of the power cord to her temples again? Of course not. You give life support, insert an IV, maybe administer an anticonvulsant. You bring her to the emergency room where a brain scan is performed. Later, an EEG will be done to see if there is slowing of residual seizure activity. She's closely watched. Confusion is to be expected. The only question is how much and for how long. Recurrent seizures, called epilepsy, are sometimes something neurologists are supposed to do their best to prevent. Yet, many psychiatrists are systematically programming entire series of convulsions. It isn't that easy to kindle a human brain into convulsing. The brain's natural resistance to seizing must be overcome by a threshold amount of energy. The minimum or threshold amount of energy is substantial, and it must be necessary to trigger a convulsion, damaging, typically producing an organic brain syndrome, usually limited to amnesia and apathy, or in 10% euphoria. But there have been numerous documented instances of acute cerebral hemorrhaging and infarcts, ongoing cognitive problems, even spontaneous epileptic seizures, both acute and chronic. Leeching was rationalized on the basis of medieval notions of humors, and very similarly, electroconvulsive therapy is rationalized on the basis of myths of mental illness. There can be no such thing as a mental illness, although as a label, it's equivalent to hanging a sign around a person's neck, garbage. I don't care what they say, the mental health business is the stigmatization business and nothing more or less. It's hardest to see the air we breathe. If you think you have an open mind, test it by reading something by Thomas Sowers. Consider the possibility there are no such things as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, except in the imagination of psychiatrists. Consider the possibility that these words don't stand for diseases just like diabetes, that they have no concrete reference. The brain can have disease, and it can be proven by testing. The mind cannot have a disease in anything but a metaphorical sense. Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, inadequate personality, and all the other nonsense syllables in the psychiatric lexicon exist only in the minds of believers. They have never turned up on a brain scan or a blood test, and they lead to equally imaginary treatments. Electroconvulsive therapy is the grand prix of such psychiatric treatments. It is no less harmful today than it was when Cerulletti and Biney invented it in Rome in 1938. Cerulletti and Biney's swine wave voltage regulated straight from the wall machine put out 70 joules, while today's machines are quite capable of administering 150. The joule is a common measure of energy allowing for comparison of energy in its various forms, heat, electrical, mechanical. Doug was on hard copy this past February 26. He and Diane Loper were instrumental in getting the Texas law in place protecting children from electroconvulsive therapy. By the way, there are thalamic hemorrhages found at autopsy carried out 1 hour after the death of a previously completely healthy 57-year-old man who received 5 electric shocks, 120 volts, 2 seconds, or 0.2 seconds. Quote, but soon afterwards, his mental state deteriorated again, and it was decided to give him another series. After the second shock, the patient awoke as usual and went home. Contrary to his former behavior, he kept to his bed this time and fell slowly into condition unrelieved drowsiness. 2 days later, he began to vomit spontaneously. He lapsed into a deep coma and died on November 12th, 6 days after his last seventh shock. And that was in, and there was an article on vascular changes in the brain in a fatality following electroconvulsive therapy, the Journal of Neuropathology and Experimental Neurology, volume 10, page 309. So when people tell you it's safe, it's effective, it does wonders, well, it didn't do wonders for that man. He's dead. And is he alone? No. And here is just one of the quotes in the Scientific Journal at the time. Quote, the clinical picture and its obvious development in connection with electric shock treatment indicated, quote, a seizure and hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain, unquote. The massive bleeding illustrated above is probably not as common, but some breakdown of the blood-brain barrier occurs with each and every shock. Reporting deaths from electroconvulsive therapy is rarely done voluntarily. Texas now requires such reports, and according to the Houston Chronicle, quote, 8 people died in Texas within 2 weeks of receiving electric convulsive therapy, unquote. Those 8 were among 1,600 recipients, yields a death rate of far higher than accounted for by anesthesia alone. But exactly the same statistic found in an earlier review. Electricity follows the shortest course when going through the brain and the least resistance, like blood vessels and non-insulated axons. It induces spasm in the vessel walls, a pressure spike consistently over 200 systolic and subsequent lactic acid buildup. The blood vessel walls become fatigued, swollen, and leaky. This is known as breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, and it isn't good for the brain. MRI scans in 14 patients showed edema peaking 6 hours after each and every shock, quote, consistent with an extensive but temporary breakdown of the blood-brain barrier during electroconvulsive therapy, unquote. And that was in the British Journal of Psychiatry, volume 987, page 69. Electroconvulsive therapy is being used with increasing frequency on the elderly who have a hard time getting respect for anything, least of all their minds. And it's actually being promoted as an instrument of screening memory drugs. Electroconvulsive therapy is an excellent laboratory paradigm or model for both epilepsy and amnesia. For many years, pharmaceutical researchers with drug companies have been using electroconvulsive therapy on animals as an effective screen for anticonvulsants like Dilantin. Now with demographics driving, the race is on for memory-enhancing drugs, and electroconvulsive therapy is being used to screen for them. Rats are taught to jump before their floor grid is zapped by learning a signal, a light or buzzer. This is called a condition avoidance. Then the experimental animals are given electric shock, and a predictable percentage actually forget to jump. Then they're given test drugs, shock, and the grid again to see if they do it better. This is okay, they say, with all those companies. The troublesome thing is that the National Institute of Mental Health has awarded many millions of taxpayer dollars to grants to the people doing this. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Let's go to our first guest. That is just a small preamble to what will be an extended coverage of electroconvulsive therapy and an ongoing effort to share a broader perspective than the one currently portrayed by the mass media, that it's safe, effective, almost trendy to have, just like all the tranquilizers now. Any and every problem is immediately a knee-jerk reaction to a tranquilizer. My first guest, Dr. Moiru Dolan. D-O-L-A-N. She is an internal medicine physician in private practice in Austin, Texas. She received her medical training at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Dr. Dolan's work consists largely of consulting services to government health agencies, attorneys, nonprofit patient advocacy groups, with a particular emphasis on electric shock therapy. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Dolan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Dolan, can you describe the history of shock therapy, including how shock treatment was invented, the science behind shock as a therapy, and the political uses of shock therapy?
Well, that's a big order. Let me start with the history there. When we look back in the history of medicine in general, we can see all sorts of fraudulent therapies down through the ages, and many of these have fallen into the mental category. Starting with this whole idea that if you can cause a fever in someone, then perhaps you can drive out the mysterious spirits. And actually, induction of a fever at one time was a treatment for people with epilepsy who were thought to be possessed. And that kind of went over into the mental field, if somebody was acting abnormal or deranged or had unacceptable behavior, they would actually try to purge them of what was considered at that time the bad humors or the evil spirits by fever or giving medications that would actually cause vomiting or diarrhea, that type of thing. So what we have in the 20th century is really just an extension of this way of thinking that there was some physical thing that was causing the emotional upset. So although there was advances in technology and medicine, there was really no change in the tactics of psychiatrists who latch onto the coattails of real scientific progress. There was a Hungarian psychiatrist, Ladislaw von Meduna, who postulated that just like matter, insanity and epilepsy could not occupy the same brain at the same time. So here again you have this idea of insanity or abnormal behavior being likened to a physical entity, which, as you pointed out, there has been no scientifically documented study showing any abnormality whatsoever in genetics, in blood testing, or in scans under the microscope or anywhere else that we can see that correlates with a specific behavior. Well, this theory of von Meduna was embraced by the psychiatrist you mentioned, Irgo Saletti, and he had experience with electroshock of pigs in slaughterhouses. What a beginning for a psychiatrist. He actually applied that experience to induce epileptic convulsions in his psychiatric inmates in order to, quote, drive their psychoses away, end quote. Again, the idea that there's something physical there that has to be driven out. Well, Sir Leti's theories and practice quickly spread to, at that time, an increasingly fascist Italy. From there, German psychiatrists picked up the technique, and by 1940, it was spread around the world, including being very popular here in America. As your listeners may or may not know, a lot of the psychiatrists who participated in the extermination programs under Hitler, for which the model was extermination in mental institutions, were invited over after the war as distinguished professors and continued their practice here in America well after the war. Well, electroshock, it was quickly determine what it actually did. It induced a nerve-wracking convulsion on the patient and caused irreversible brain damage. This led to the use of electroshock to actually destroy the personality of individuals as a way of controlling them. In fact, psychiatrist Abraham Meyerson in 1942 reported that, and this is his quote, "Some of the very best cures that one gets are in those individuals whom one renders almost to amentia," end quote. Amentia means mindlessness. Now, also in 1942, another Italian psychiatrist, Lucchini Bini, B-I-N-I, he first suggested the use of repetitive shock treatments daily for certain patients, and he called his procedure annihilation therapy. So when we look back at the beginnings of electroshock, there was no backing off. This was truly truth in advertising, annihilation therapy, amentia. Well, the same system of repetitive daily shock application was used by 1960s psychiatrist Ewan Cameron. He actually did Canadian research under the funding of the CIA, and this is available, widely available now through Freedom of Information Act. He called his methods, his own title, deprogramming, and this is actually still used in certain psychiatric facilities. The object was through shock-induced brain damage to actually erase the personality of the individual, force him into more of an infantile state, where his thinking patterns could then be so-called re-established by a presumably right-thinking psychiatrist. So this is what we see through the 30s, 40s, and 50s and 60s with this. 50s and 60s were the real heyday when, as you're mentioning now, it seems to be coming back of it's popular to go get your shock treatment. Now, bringing it up more to the present time, in 1995, Dr. Peter Sterling, a University of Pennsylvania neuroscientist, he testified before a legislative body in regards to psychiatric electroshock, And he described it in detail as a procedure which unquestionably damages the brain. There's very simple known mechanisms, some of which you mentioned, Gary. It causes an epileptic fit. There's a great increase in blood pressure. It causes small hemorrhages in the brain. And what we need to know about brain cells is when a hemorrhage occurs in the brain, nerve cells die, and nerve cells are not replaced. That's it. And certainly there's plenty of studies showing before and after scans in people who have gotten electroshock showing actual brain shrinkage, what we call atrophy. Now, sometimes that can happen from alcohol, it can happen from toxins, it can happen from viruses. The most common time that we see brain atrophy is as someone ages, so it's like accelerating the aging process tremendously. Another thing, as you mentioned, electroshock breaks down the protective blood-brain barrier, and that is a mechanism that our bodies have developed that insulate the brain from toxic substances in the blood. Well, rupture of the barrier also causes death of nerve cells, and as you mentioned, swelling of brain tissue. The blood supply in that immediate local area is totally stopped, which means no oxygen to the brain. So we see a picture that's very similar to miniature little strokes in the brain. The other thing that happens, and this is the whole thing, the whole purpose of electroshock is to induce a seizure. The excitotoxicity, in other words, jazzing up the neuron, the nerve cell itself in the brain, can be brought on by repeated electroshock in which nerve cells literally die due to overactivity. And this is thought to be a significant contributor to accumulated brain damage. Now, these documents on what actually is going on with the brain are actually supplied by the proponents and advocates of electroshock themselves, because after all, they're the ones who are collecting the cadavers to study. So all of this that I'm reporting to you can be found in the standard neurologic literature with authors such as Fink and Dr. Coffey and Dr. Sackheim, who are the three main proponents of electroshock in this country currently. So I'm just going to quote from some of their articles. We go back 20 years ago in the journal Science. It was documented by Cotman that ECT disrupts protective protein production by brain cells. So just the shock experience does that, and then the brain is left to try to carry on with its normal functions without that protection anymore. Dr. Edward Coffey, who is, again, a leading proponent of ECT, conducted a study at Duke University Medical Center in the Durham VA hospital looking at MRI scans of patients before and after ECT. Out of 35 patients that he studied, 8 had new changes on MRI after one shock session. Now, that's 22%, or greater than 1 in 5, that actually had demonstrable anatomic brain abnormalities after one shock. Among those with the brain changes, one had a stroke, and then 2 had new abnormal neurologic signs on exam within 6 months of the ECT. So not only did they see these brain changes on the pictures, but a good group of, you know, some of these individuals actually had clinical changes. Many of the changes are what we call subclinical or not obvious right off the bat, or if you're not looking for them. But certainly with shock sessions being repeated, and now what's getting popular is to have so-called maintenance ECT, where the people actually come in as outpatients or have very brief hospital stays in the weeks and months after their initial series of anywhere from 5 to 8 shock sessions. We can see that there can be a cumulative effect on the brain. Now, Weinberger looked at another proponent of shock. He looked at the effects of ECT on the brains of schizophrenics by comparing brain CT scans of those who had ECT with schizophrenics who never received shock. And he documented that cerebral atrophy, which is another way of saying brain shrinkage, this was significantly more common in those who had ever been shocked, even if it was just one treatment. Another CT scan study done by Calloway looked at a similar group and confirmed that frontal lobe atrophy was significantly more common in ECT recipients. A study in England looked at the brain CT scans of 101 depressed patients who received ECT compared to 52 normal volunteers, and they found a significant relationship between the treatment of ECT and actual brain shrinkage. Now, Most significantly in that study, the brain abnormalities correlated only with receiving shock and not with how old the person was, whether or not they used alcohol, what sex they were, their family history of mental illness, how old they were when they first got their psychiatric diagnosis, or how severe their mental illness was. And that's straight from the words of the authors. So these proponents of ECT have been documenting the adverse effects for years, but what they've really avoided looking at is the lack of efficacy and the death rate, and that's really what I'd like to share with you. There was recently a 60 Minutes interview of Harold Sackheim, who is the number one advocate for ECT in the country right now. And he was just on 60 Minutes a couple weeks ago, and that was exactly 14 days after he had published an article in the Journal of the AMA in where he actually delineated, out of 316 patients that were convinced to undergo five shock sessions, a great percentage of them backed out of the treatment, refused further participation in the study, or actually had medical side effects of ECT. So he stopped counting those folks. That amounted to 195 of the initial 316. Of the 121 patients that were left, 100% of them had lack of effectiveness of the ECT within 6 months. So his own study, and in fact in his abstract, his words are, there is a 100% relapse rate. So his own study verified that there was absolutely no effectiveness of this treatment, and yet 2 weeks later he was on 60 Minutes claiming that it was one of the most effective treatments available.
Just a question for you. Doesn't he have, or does he have, I should say, an economic interest in the production of electroconvulsive therapy?
Well, speaking of economics, the American Psychiatric Association actually has a fact sheet for patients on ECT and does have a section there on what it costs. And it today is considered to be the single most lucrative procedure offered by psychiatrists. A course of ECT treatment, according to the APA fact sheet, will usually cost between $2,400 and $6,400. And this is actually thought to be outdated information. So up to $6,400 per course of treatment is extremely lucrative for everybody involved. Regarding Sackheim in particular, he did specify in his JAMA article that he used a MECTA, M-E-C-T-A, a MECTA machine, which is made in Canada. And although he claims that he has not received any funds directly from the MECTA company, they do contribute to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars to his, quote, laboratory.
Well, that's like saying if you decorate someone's home, you're not giving them the money directly. It's their home. A laboratory is the home of a scientist. What do we know went into that?
Well, who knows where his laboratory is? But there's several people. There's another producer of shock machines called Somatics. And Abrams is a big proponent of electroshock, and he actually has a part ownership in the electroshock machine company. Now, he claims that he disclosed this to the publishers that were publishing his articles, but they claim that, no, they never got that disclosure. There's definite financial ties between device manufacturers and the companies. There is a very interesting website that goes into detail on this called banshock.org, banshock.org, that really goes into detail on the financial relationships. But like I said, what they fail to go into, even though they do talk about some of the brain damaging effects, is the actual lack of efficacy. In a large New York study, death rates from suicide among depressed patients given ECT were actually slightly higher when looked at the one-year mark compared to people who got other treatment for depression. By 5 years, the suicide rate was actually the same for depressed patients who got ECT as those who didn't. So it has no efficacy whatsoever in suicide. There was a large University of Iowa study of treatment effectiveness. It looked at 1,076 depressed patients, and they were categorized according to whether they received shock or an antidepressant in high dose or an antidepressant in low dose, or neither, no treatment, no shock or medications. And long-term follow-up in that study showed that all groups had the same suicide rates, indicating that the incidence of suicide is not affected at all by treatment, including no treatment, incidentally. And the authors of this study actually concluded, and I'll quote here, therefore, ECT cannot be characterized as life-saving now as it once was in the past, end quote. That's a study by Black and Associates from the Annals of Clinical Psychiatry. And there's multiple other studies that document the same findings. ECT does not prevent suicide in depressed patients. It's often heralded as, oh, are you going to say that this desperate person can't get this last-ditch treatment? You may be, you know, leaving him to suicide, and that actually has no validity whatsoever in the statistics. But I really want to talk about the actual death rates, of looking at this as not just a brain damaging procedure and something that leaves you with permanent memory loss and possible epilepsy, but actual death. I am speaking to you from Texas, where we are the only state that has a mandatory reporting of death within 14 days of ECT. And in the 3 years that that law has been in effect, we have collected data that shows the death rate is 1 in 208. Compare that to the American Psychiatric Association's information on ECT, and it gives a death rate of no more than 1 in 10,000. Now, when actually pressed about where they got that number, they do admit that it's so-called impressionistic. In other words, they made it up. But there is plenty of data showing the death rate is more like anywhere from 1 in 134 to 1 in about 208, as we see here in Texas. Now, there was a very large study of 3,288 patients getting shock in Monroe County, New York, and ECT recipients were found to actually have an increased death rate from all causes. Another study at Brown University looked at 65 patients who were hospitalized and treated for depression. 37 of those patients got shock, and they had survival rates of 73% at the one-year mark. Compare that to depressed patients who didn't receive shock. Their survival rate was 96.4% at the one-year mark. When we carry that out to 2 years, the people who received electroshock, only 54% of them were alive. Compare that to over 90% of those who didn't receive shock, still alive at the two-year mark. It even carries out to the three-year mark. Those who received shock, only 51% of them were still alive at 3 years, in contrast to 75% of those who didn't receive shock. And this is actually most impressive if you could just imagine a graph of this in your mind. This is a death-dealing procedure. There's a study that of a smaller group of patients that was even more astounding, that was reported in the British Journal of Psychiatry in 1996. They found that the risk of death was actually doubled in patients who got ECT, and they carried that out in a seven-year follow-up. The first 3 years, like I said, of mandated recording of death within 14 days of ECT in the state of Texas showed a total of 21 deaths. 11 of those were cardiovascular, including massive heart attacks and strokes. 3 were respiratory, and 6 were suicide, which really underscores a total lack of efficacy. In fact, one of these who's counted in this statistic, I knew in detail about the case. This fellow was at a hospital here, and he was refusing electroshock, had already gotten a couple treatments and didn't want it anymore. And they were attempting to restrain him, and rather than get electroshock, he ran down the entire hallway of that psychiatric ward and burst through the window and fell to his death. So, you know, not only did the so-called treatment help him in any way, shape, or form, he was not suicidal before he went into that hospital. It actually caused his death. So aside from death, we actually have the people, the much greater number of people who are going around surviving but with permanent epilepsy. We look at the age-adjusted incidence of new seizures after shock. It's fivefold greater than the incidence found in the non-psychiatric population. That was a study from the journal Neurology in 1983. So a 5 times increase in the incidence of permanent seizures. Now, remember, the idea of electroshock is to induce a seizure. Harold Sackheim feels the seizure has to be at least 20 to 25 seconds long to be so-called therapeutic. Recall that a seizure is a total disruption of normal and orderly electronic transmission in the brain. As you can see on the brainwave EEG test, the needle just goes wild like an earthquake or something. So it's really a complete disruption of normal transmission. And there's a fivefold increased incidence in people who get shot compared to the normal population of those folks going on just to develop regular old epilepsy, where they'll just have a seizure out in life later on, just have regular seizures, can't drive, the whole deal, just as virtue of getting electroshock. There's another large review on the well-known complication of epilepsy, and these researchers, this was reported in the American Journal of Psychiatry, actually found that seizure activity following ECT was very high even if the people didn't have actual breakthrough seizures. In other words, even if they didn't have the physical convulsing, the incidence of abnormal brainwave testing showing spots of seizure activity was very, very significant. The American Psychiatric Association's fact sheet also talks about the incidence of memory loss, which they claim is only 1 in 200 and is trivial and temporary. We compare that to data from the California Department of Mental Health in their Office of Human Rights. This is publicly available data, and it reveals that over 99% of shock recipients complain of persistent memory loss 3 months following treatment. And those are people who only got the average number of sessions of 5 or 6 sessions. Today we're seeing people often getting their initial series of ECT being more like 8 or 10 sessions. And then, like I said, what's gaining popularity because it gets insurance reimbursement is so-called maintenance ECT. So we have the numbers of persistent memory loss are probably greater than 99% and endure much longer than 3 months, which is all this study actually looked at. Even Harold Sackheim, who, like I said, was published in Journal of the AMA proving no efficacy just last month, even Sackheim indicates that cognitive effects, that's just a medical way of saying disordered thinking, particularly amnesia, lack of memory, who am I, that these can be long-lasting after shock. And he actually admits this in his chapter in a book called Cognitive Disorders, Pathophysiology and Treatment, which came out in 1992. The conclusion that amnesia can be a long-lasting effect of shock is arrived at by many, many other shock proponents who have great experience in this, including Squire and Weiner, which are two, again, real advocates in this country. They have done long-term follow-up on cognitive side effects, particularly memory, and it's very well documented that incidence of memory impairment goes well beyond what the APA is putting out. And that is why when people just read the information put out by the American Psychiatric Association, they cannot be considered as being giving informed consent for this treatment, because they have not been informed and can't possibly give consent because they have actually false data. And that's one of the biggest issues, and we're trying to get some more legislation around that here in Texas, and hopefully other states will follow suit. Because the information is really based on a little publication by the American Psychiatric Association and some smooth talking by the psychiatrist, who, after all, has much to gain financially for this, rather than true objective data that needs to be widely available. All too often, well-meaning family members in desperate straits are looking to the psychiatrist as a hand of help, and really are very willing to trust anything they say, and I believe that that's really played upon, because there is no such thing as informed consent in this field. As you mentioned with this case right there in New York, how can someone be supposedly fit to give their consent at one moment, and then after the so-called treatment, which is supposed to straighten them out, all of a sudden they're not in any shape to refuse the treatment? We just see this all too often. Also, in my own experience talking to patients who have had electroshock, it's very common that it's coerced. that they're offered a straitjacket in a padded room and won't be able to get out till their next judge hearing, a competency hearing in 30 to 60 days, unless they sign on the dotted line for electroshock. I've actually been involved in reviewing law cases, malpractice cases, where someone who wasn't wearing his needed reading glasses and spoke only Spanish and was illiterate had a X signed on his informed consent form that was all in English. I mean, this is the level of so-called informed consent in this field. People really need to be informed of that, really need to be aware of what's actually going on. When we see that, well, gee, somebody's signing up for it, if you're libertarian, you're sort of saying, well, what's wrong with that? But if it's not true informed consent, and, you know, like this fellow in New York, it's after the fact that they're going, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? I want out, and I very clearly want out. But then, by then, they've got you. They have actually induced brain damage and are claiming that you're incompetent as a sign, in fact, of the illness. It's all too common that psychiatrists feel when someone declares themselves well, they just add that to their list of symptoms of their delusion. The current, to go back to your question on the history, the current way that electroshock is administered is different from what we have known in the past and different from how the movie Cuckoo's Nest characterized it. Currently, they actually give a paralyzing agent and general anesthesia. So it actually looks very much from the outside like any old tonsillectomy or appendectomy. And again, in the American Psychiatric Association literature, the procedure is really likened to no more than a minor outpatient elective surgery. But as we see from these statistics on death and lack of efficacy and disordered thinking and memory afterward, it's anything but. So, but it looks very, very antiseptic, and there's no more jerking around of the patient or convulsing. That's all masked. However, the brainwave monitor is still hooked up to the patient so that the psychiatrist can assess that he has induced his 20 to 25 second seizure. Actually, the APA recommends a 1 minute seizure. But anyway, Dr. Sackheim goes with the 25 second seizure repeatedly. So we don't actually see that anymore. And then as soon as the person wakes up, they're sedating them and they're giving them medications for the inevitable headache that follows. And then by the time they start to come around, 48 hours later, they're rolling them back in for another shock session. So this is what they mean by new and improved. It's all antiseptic now and looks like legitimate surgery. Just another example of psychiatry riding on the coattails of legitimate medicine. Just like they call it a mental illness with no basis in fact and doesn't fulfill any of the definitions scientifically of actually an illness or a disease process, they are actually calling this a medical life-saving procedure, and it's anything but.
Dr. Dolan, I just completed an extensive review of the scientific literature concerning the disease, so-called disease, ADD and ADHD. And as a scientist and a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, and also an instructor in a course on research methodology, I have some expertise in how to determine the type of study I'm reviewing. Even frequently what will be said in the text of a study is not always what is ultimately reported as the outcome, much like you said in the Journal of the American Medical Association when we were contacting some New York legislators recently. They pointed out the Journal of the American Medical Association just recommended electroconvulsive therapy. And I said, did you read the article? It shows that 100% of the people who received it after 6 months had no benefit. Therefore, it is lacking in efficacy, and here's the downside. Of course, the psychiatrist, who have forever been trying to seek a sense of legitimacy on a scientific level, have claimed that a lot of these conditions are absolute positively real. That's why we have 6 million kids on medications, over 5 million on Ritalin. I couldn't find a study, not one study in their literature, showing the differences in a brain of a child diagnosed with ADD and ADHD and a child not diagnosed. And I asked them, I said, show me the difference. Show me the biochemistry. You say it's an imbalance in brain chemicals? Show me. Show me the blood workup. Take a blood sample. Show me. Show me any kind of EEG. There's nothing. Now, I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who's taken a look down this path and seen that they don't have the efficacy. And yet we continue, the media continues, Time Magazine, the New York Times Magazine section, New York Magazine. Suddenly there's an enormous interest in redoing it like it's the procedure that is completely verified. Nobody even goes back and says, is it real? Do these people really have these conditions? Is this treatment benefiting them? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, exactly. And unfortunately, there is just such an unwillingness to look at the actual words. It was really in the first page of the article by Sackheim in his abstract, his own words, saying that 100% relapse, and even the Chicago paper picked up the article, and they reported that 84% relapse. I don't know where they got that. Sackheim himself even said 100% due, and I really even question the whether somebody even had a remittance or a temporary lightening of their depression, because these proponents of ECT document over and over again in their literature that what the shock effect on the brain can actually do is induce somewhat of a delirium, which is a definable medical condition where someone is just, we've all probably either seen this or experienced this, where you have a tremendous shock and you're somewhat delirious afterward. That's what's being claimed as the temporary response, but then they ultimately all, quote, relapse. In other words, those are the exact words, and that's the exact assessment of his own data by Sackheim in the March 13th JAMA article. It didn't stop him 2 weeks later from going onto a 60-minute show and saying that it is one of the most effective treatments that we know. And that really does need to be exposed. So you don't even need to, know anything about statistical analysis or chi-square tests or anything, just to read the guy's own words where he's admitting that it is 100% ineffective.
My concern also is how many children and senior citizens are now being targeted for this procedure. Both children and the elderly are of special concern. What are the added risks of administering electroconvulsive therapy to either of these groups? And are there any laws limiting the use on them?
An added risk. For one thing, we really don't have data on what is the effect of electroshock on the developing brain. Common sense would tell you, for heaven's sakes, leave it alone. I mean, you'd be very worried about your child who would bite into a lamp cord or stick his finger into the electrical outlet. But, of course, there haven't been any controlled studies on it. There are now three states that do have laws that do not allow electroshock to be administered to children, and Texas is one of those. I believe Tennessee is another, and I think California has some guidelines on persons under 14. Texas is the most stringent, not allowing ECT on people under the age of 16. But in New Jersey, a three-year-old can be shocked and is shocked. There's definite concerns about growth retardation, impairment of their immune system, inability to learn, and, of course, the development of long-term seizures in children. In the elderly, there is actually a little bit more data than there is in children. The Mayo Clinic actually did a study of 34 people over the age of 85. I mean, this is the oldest old who were subjected to shock. And they documented that 79% suffered treatment complications. 32% of those had confusion and delirium, 67% had high blood pressure, and you'll see these numbers add up to more than 100% because often people had more than one adverse effect. 18% had serious heart arrhythmias during the shock that required immediate treatment. Two people just had changes on their EKG. Three people fell. One person actually had a hip fracture due to a fall. So you take people that are... These were people from the community. They were walking, talking, to some degree managing their own affairs and obviously on medications for a variety of medical conditions, and they actually found it right to shock them and got nearly an 80% treatment complication rate. And this study did not carry it out over several months to look at accelerated death rates or who developed seizures afterward. In the elderly, the blood vessels are very fragile. They may already have some brain shrinkage and really can't afford to lose any more. They already have a risk of stroke and heart attack and blood clots and things. So to add a total disruption of the blood-brain barrier and to introduce electricity that would cause complete chaos in the normal transmission can really only worsen it. Now, the ECT advocates, Dr. Coffey and his associate, Dr. Feigl, found that 10 out of 87, so that's 11% of elderly patients that were given shock for depression, remained delirious in the 48 hours between shock sessions for no reason other than the shock itself. So they're basically inducing delirium. In this group of patients, they showed that there was MRI brain scans that had 90% showed new abnormalities. And a lot of these abnormalities were found in what's called the basal ganglia area of the brain, which is one that has a lot to do with movement disorders. 90% also had white matter lesions. So the white matter is where we have our higher functions and thinking, personality, that type of thing. So again, these were documented in the elderly by the proponents and the advocates of ECT themselves. There was a study on animals looking at, well, how about if we give supplementary oxygen, some vitamin E, give medications to control the abnormal heart rhythms to animals that we give electroshock to. Does that help their brain outcomes? And it turns out it doesn't help it whatsoever, that doing all these measures that are pointed at as a to support the claim that electroshock is new and improved. We now have oxygen. We don't let them bite their tongues. We paralyze them. We treat their abnormal heart rhythms. Well, it does not, in animal studies anyway, reduce the amount of ultimate brain damage that is being done. So I think that the elderly are very similar to the childhood population in that they're especially susceptible for different reasons. The elderly already have atrophy, they've got fragile anatomy, and the child, of course, is just now having a developing brain. But it's unfortunately the children's subsequent learning difficulties are all too often blamed on the underlying mental illness, right, rather than the treatment being looked at. And like I said, there is a real paucity of controlled studies because the psychiatrists are not really anxious to go out there and document their own wrongdoing.
Dr. Dolan, we're out of time. I really appreciate you being on today. You have a web page for people to go to. Could you give it to us?
I don't have a web page of my own, but I would really refer people to www.banshock.org, banshock.org. And that is also has a lot of links to other sites that people can go to. Support Coalition International has a website that's got some interesting things on it. And if anybody has an individual in their family or a loved one that they know that is undergoing this or feeling that there's some coercion or lack of informed consent is the main thing, they can call the Citizens Commission on Human Rights at 1-800-572-2905. And they just have a wealth of information. And that particular group really has taken this as their issue and has done so much to forward patient knowledge and shining the light on the psychiatrists in this field.
I really appreciate your concern, and certainly the Citizens Commission have done an absolutely Herculean job on this as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.
That was Dr. Moro Dolan. I'm Gary Nall. We do not have a number right now to give you for tapes of the program. This is a continuation of our series, of course, on abuses in psychiatry, specifically looking at electroconvulsive therapy. Now, one quick announcement. I will give you the date and location of our demonstration. We are going to be doing a demonstration for Paul Henry Thomas to be held on Monday, May 21st at noon, downtown at 120 Broadway in New York City. If you intend to come, please go to my webpage and let us know, GaryNall.com. Again, put it on your calendar. It's your time now to show that you're concerned on issues. So many people never do anything. Now you can. May 21st, noon, downtown 120 Broadway. We'll have multiple speakers. I'll be presenting a scientific paper, and we'll be seeking legislative action as well as to get Paul Henry Thomas out of Pilgrim State. Have a good day, everyone.